This time, we're going to call House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect, the time is 1 p.m. Today is Wednesday, March 18th, 2009. We have Representative Gutenberg, Olson, Co-Chair Johnson, Kawasaki, Seaton, my friend Peggy Wilson, and myself, Representative Newman. We do have a quorum on the agenda today. We're going to start with House Joint Resolution 21. Then we're going to go to House Bill 70, Alaska Grown Products, and we'll see if we can get started on HB 43 with gooey ducks. Just for interested parties, again on 143 with the mixing zone, in conversations that I had with the commissioner yesterday, Commissioner Harding, they are working on some language that they feel can meet the intent of the initiative and still allow everybody to continue to moving forward. So that's good news. Or 134, I mean, excuse me. So I think we finally hit some common ground, but I'm glad to see that the administration is finally coming into the loop here and voicing an opinion on this. That's the big part for me. But again, House Joint Resolution, Ground Fisheries License. We would like to welcome Representative Osterman. I think that's the first time or second time to our committee. I wasn't here the first time. Name and affiliation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Alan Osterman. I am representative of District 36.
Go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Joint Resolution number 21 is an effort on my part to try to slow down the process of taking away access to some of the fisheries. Just a little bit of background, and the reason why I'm here today is the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which handles the fisheries outside of 3 miles in the federal waters, has a history of taking fisheries and either restricting the access to them so much, or even to the extent of giving away the resource into an IFQ or a quota system. And one of the few remaining fisheries left that has got fair access to it, and that is the Pacific cod fishing in the Gulf of Alaska. There's several methods of catching the cod in the Gulf of Alaska. One of them is the trawl industry, or the, as better known as the draggers. The other one is the fixed gear group, which is the pot fishermen and the long line fishermen. And the third is the jig fishermen. In the Gulf of Alaska, we have a Pacific cod fishery inside 3 miles, where they are basically unlimited. Fisheries, the jig fisheries is wide open, and anybody can get a jig machine and put it on a skiff and go out, or they can buy up to 5 jig machines and put them on, say, a small seiner or something like that and go jig fishing. And the only cap on the jig fishing industry is that they've got a limit of 25% of the total catch, the TAC, total allowable catches, and they can only max out at 25% of that.
On that point, Representative Osterman, could you talk about any issues that may be arised within the 3 mile limit, or is that managed in your opinion, and is everybody happy with that? Could you expand on it a little bit?
As far as the management within the 3 miles, I think it's fine. I have seen no problems other than the fact that there are sometimes decisions have to be made between the federal fishery, which is a what they call parallel fishery, the federal fishery that can also fish inside of 3, that they call it a parallel. Then there's also the state water fishery, which is separate from the federal fishery at some time. But right now, there's really no problem in reference to the state water fishery.
Thank you.
Within those three elements of the fishery, the one that we're concerned about is the fixed gear, which is made up of the pot fishermen and the longline fishermen. And back in 95-97, the council decided they wanted to slow down the entrance into this fixed gear fishery. And so they put a limited license permit program together, very similar to the limited entry program we have in salmon. And they went, at that point in time, they took the history of who'd been catching cod. You could have caught one cod or you could have caught 10,000 cod during that period of time, and it would give you a license. So we ended up with about 883 licenses within the central Gulf of Alaska. that deal with this fixed gear fishery. As with most fisheries, the North Pacific Council had been heading down the line of what some people call rationalization, where you give away the resource. And there's a different opinion about what rationalization really is. In my view, anytime you deal with a fishery and you change the structure of it, that's a rationalization program. I look at limiting it of salmon as a rationalized program. So when we get to this conversation, some people look at, say, the word rationalization, they think about similar to the halibut IFQ, where they actually took that resource and gave it to the shareholders or to the fishermen who have now control of that IFQ. And it's not an access issue. That's actually basically ownership, although the federal legislation, the Magnuson-Stevens Act, has a clause in it that says that at any point in time we can come and take this back away from you. But in perception and in everybody's mind, that resource really has been given to those fishermen who hold the quota on it.
And Representative Osterman, if you don't mind, if the members have questions as you're ongoing, just let me know. But I would like to recognize that we do have Representative Edgman, which certainly commercial fisheries is very important in his district, and Representative Tuck.
Thank you, sir. The whole discussion, you know, a lot of people don't consider salmon a rationalized issue because they associate the giving away of the resource, the rationalized program. So whenever we get into that discussion in the Gulf of Alaska, it turns into somewhat of a Donnybrook because nobody really, you know, everybody's talking on different terms. But in 2000, the North Pacific Council went ahead and implemented this limited license program, the LLP, for the federal waters. And since then, they've been looking at, and even in their own problem statements, they talk about rationalization of how you're going to rationalize this program. And they went on that guideline from then until 2006 when Governor Palin was elected, and she said no more rationalization in the Gulf, period. Stop the rationalization. The council accepted that. And then even in their some of their problem statements, they say that in 2006 we stopped the rationalization. And then we've gone to a more discrete method of rationalizing these fisheries. Now, that problem statement was back in 2006. And in 2008 and 2009, when you read their problem statement, they don't talk about stopping it in 2006, and they don't talk about being discreetly rationalizing in another method. They just talk about the economic issues dealing with trying to protect those participants who are currently in the fishery. And so when they first started looking at this thing after 2006, the initial discussion was, all right, you got 800 and some licenses, we got 300 and some fishermen that are currently fishing, and these latent licenses that are not fishing, we're just going to eliminate all those licenses, period. And those guys who are currently fishing will get the license for fishing peacod or Pacific cod. Because the original license that they gave out was what they call a groundfish license. You could fish anything. For example, the draggers, they have 11 or 12 or however many species that they catch as bycatch when they're fishing for cod. So they have quite a number of species that they catch. In the fixed gear, it really is just strictly cod on this LLP and this groundfish. So 98 or 99% of the fish that the fixed gear guys, the pots and the long line catch, are Pacific cod. And so,
Representative Osterman,
yes.
Just on that point, with the draggers or the ground bottom fishers, as you call them, when they collect, you said that they catch up to 11 different species, are they considered bycatch or are they a usable product that they process?
Some of those are bycatch and usable. And so they bring them ashore, and they're allowed a certain percentage normally on their bycatch of how much bycatch they can take of certain species. Some of them are prohibited species, such as halibut. They're not allowed to retain halibut. They actually have to throw the halibut overboard and not retain it and not bring it in, not sell it. So it goes those, both ways there.
Are those probably dead fish?
Probably.
Thank you.
So when they got into the discussion of eliminating the 500 and some licenses, just eliminating them, there was an upcry, and everybody said, well, wait a minute, this is only real fishery that people can access into on an ongoing basis. that you shouldn't eliminate those. You should leave these licenses out there for people to move up into the fishery and buy a license and move on into the industry. So the council then took another direction and stood back and wanted to take another look at it. So the current thing that they've got before the council, and they're actually making their final action the 1st of April at their meeting in Anchorage on 1st of April for this, they've decided that they would take those current license, 300 plus license, whatever it is, and actually put a cod endorsement, specifically for PCOD endorsement, on those licenses that are currently fishing. In other words, if you fish during this period of time, you received a cod endorsement. And they've got several different options within their program that you could have fished for in this time period or this time period. And the range of licenses that would be putting out there, something like 110 to 306 licenses on the high end and on the low end, depending on what criteria they chose to history that you fished PCOD and made deliveries during that period of time. And as I indicated earlier, the inside three, we have these jig fishery, and we have an Alaskan inside three cod fishery also with the fixed gear, the pots and things like that they can go out and fish. And so there is a stepping stone that can take place when somebody starts with a skiff and a jig, could go buy a few pots later on and expand his boat to a 30, 32, 38 footer and put a few pots on board and go fishing so he can build himself up. But what he can't do if this action takes place is get to the 3-mile limit. He can't go into the federal waters and into the federal fisheries that they have unless he goes and buys a license from these 300 plus cod endorsed licenses that were just given to these guys. So if he wants to get into the fishery, he's got to go over here and buy a license from one of these guys that were just given it.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have any history on what that would cost someone to go if we narrowed it down to either the 160 or the 300? Do you have any idea what we're talking about in terms of cost for a new fisherman to get into that fishery? I know it's history and it's guessing, but kind of what ballpark?
You know, that's a hard question to answer. All I can do is the most prominent thing that will leap out at you as to what happens when you reduce ownership or access to these fisheries is the halibut. When the halibut IFQ system was put in place and they created these quotas, poundage, and that poundage, by the way, as if you have X amount of quota, as the halibut stocks go up and down and manage, so does your quota goes up and down and goes with it. But at the time of the inception of the halibut IFQ, there was something in the neighborhood of $2 to $3 a pound that the value of that resource was in your IFQ poundage. In the paper about last week, I was reading somebody had some for sale. These same things that were given to them with a value of $2 to $3 a pound are now $26 a pound. He had 2,000 pounds of IFQs, and he's going to sell them. And he's got, instead of $2 or $3 that he was given to that IFQ at, or he maybe even have bought some at a higher price, but he's now selling it at $26. The principle, obviously, is the fact that you take something that's got a value. And I think, and I'm not positive of this because I haven't had that research done, but they're currently, the guys that are currently buying an LLP license are around $2,000 they're paying for one of those 800 and some licenses, limited licenses that were originally put in. What that value will be, and once you restrict the access and restrict the number of cod endorsements, I can't tell you. I mean, it would be strictly a guess off the top of my head. So.
Thank
but
you,
the whole process is being put in place for that. Anytime you have a limited number, you're going to have a value go up.
On that point, Representative Osterman, if you could expand just a little bit, because there was 883 permits given out, and how much did they, of those 800, what did they have to purchase those? I believe you said that they're just issued.
Now, every one of these programs, whether it was the halibut or the cod LLP or even the salmon limited entry program, they were given those licenses.
They were given to them. So if they limit that down to just 300 and only 300, the government is, in essence, give them quite a large value.
It could be a large value, yes. And particularly it depends, of course, on fishery and how important the fishery is. And the price of fish, as most of us know, watch the salmon industry, goes up and down on a constant basis, so it really depends. Actually, the price of cod right now is down. And so some people are not fishing cod just because of the price of it. So part of those latent licenses could be the price. And when the price comes back, it could come back up again.
I have Representative Seaton and Kawasaki.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just, you know, so that everybody understands the program, it also depends on size. There's a separate license for under 60 foot. The license is there, and you can expand your vessel up to 20 foot or 20%. But if you're at 58 foot, you can only expand to 60 foot. So there's an expansion, but there is a size classification. So if you had a license that was issued for a vessel that was under 60 foot, it doesn't matter whether the 20% would send you to 75 footer. You could only expand to 60 foot. And also the licenses are either trawl or fixed gear. So that you have, you know, long line and pot is one license, and trawl is a separate license. And so when we're talking about value of the licenses, you got, as the representative said, you have to look at the fishery, the gear type, and also they have those by area as well, whether it's Gulf of Alaska, Bering Sea, Western Gulf. And so when those combinations get there, the permits can get more valuable. So you can have a LLP currently that's, you know, like at about $100,000, depending upon what kind of a fishery that you have. So, but restricting the licenses down does obviously increase the value of those permits that would be sold.
And just for clarity, for our clerks, I believe Representative Seaton, LLP, limited license permit.
Yes.
So we're trying to stay away from the acronyms where a clerk doesn't have to figure that out. Representative Osterman, do you have any comment on that?
I know. It's absolutely correct.
Okay, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For an LLP, a limited license permit, if I got a limited license permit, can I hold it in perpetuity? Is there any requirement that you have to use it frequently? Or can you just hold on to it with that value being there?
That I don't know. That's part of the question, and Representative Seaton may be more in tune to what that provision is.
Representative Seaton, do you have a comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for disclosure, I do have two LLPs. One's on two different vessels. So, but yeah, those are held. There's no annual fee on them that's paid. They're assigned to a vessel, but they're owned by the person, not by the vessel. And they can be transferred back and forth from one vessel to another. But there is no time limitation on those or fishing limitation, like you must participate mm-hmm. in the fishery.
Continue.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's really the essence of what I'm trying to do, is send the message. As I indicated before, When you look at a rationalized program, whether it's to give the resource away, whether it's to go to an access program, the fishing history is what the council has used over time. My objective here is couplefold. First off, is to keep available reasonable access to the federal fishery within the Gulf of Alaska for particularly for Alaskans, but also to ask the North Pacific Council to quit giving these resources away or quit controlling the access based upon fishing history. For example, we do have, in the current fisheries that's going on, we do have people coming into that fishery right now who are fishing for history. They can see this endorsement on this cod thing as a value. So they're fishing their history right now, trying to get enough history so that they will receive an endorsement on cod. Yet they're making all their money off of crab or off of pollock or some other fishery where it's got a lot of value to it. They're making the money over there, and they're coming into the Gulf of Alaska and fishing for cod and losing money just for this history. And if we can get the council to stand up and say, we're not giving you history on the cod, it's go away. Or figure out how to make money at it, because we're not going to give you any endorsed, cod-endorsed LLP based upon your history. And if we can do that, we've made a big step forward in how we control our own destiny in Alaska. I think it's a little over 70% of those LLPs that are being fished are fished by small boats that live in coastal Alaska. And so that's who we're looking for. And we're looking at trying to get these young Alaskans who want to get into the business and buy a jig machine and then get a few pots and step into the industry, not to have some high barrier when it comes to having a federal LLP. Thank you.
Representative Osterman, you said that it's your intent to try and make sure that this fishery maintains the ability for it to be open for people who want to come into this.
Reasonable access.
Reasonable access to them. So that I'm assuming that your focus there is to make sure that there's competition. Competition improves quality of the fish. It improves pricing. I mean, there's a reason for that, isn't there? Is that part of where you're going?
Well, there's a lot of different ways of looking at what happens within the business sector of and economics of how you get into business. And each one of these fishing boats, 300 plus of them, got into this business as a business venture. They made an investment no more different than if you were to go down the street and buy a grocery store and make an investment and start a business up. The difference between fisheries and the federal side is that they've always looked at these as not necessarily the same way we would look at something on the business aspect of it. We like, in my view, the free enterprise system has worked for eons, and we should continue with the free enterprise system instead of saying that we have to protect these guys. And I understand if I was in the industry, I might feel the same way, that I've got a investment that I've made and that I want to get protected. I don't want these other boats to come in and compete with me. But that's in our own mind, that's not the way we do business. We shouldn't be doing it in the federal fisheries, no more than we do it on shore with any other business sectors that we have. The supporters of going to this endorsement say that it'll give them more stability. Well, obviously it would give them more stability. But is that our job? Is that the government's job, is to give more stability and give a basic access right to somebody and then narrow it down to where hardly anybody else can get into the industry? And that's our message.
Thank you. Do we have any more questions for Representative Osterman at this time? And we'll ask you to stay put because there always ends up more. We do have quite a few people who want to testify online, and I guess we'll start at the top of the list here. And Homer, Elia Kuzman, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record? And we are going to limit testimony to 3 minutes because we do have quite a few people who want to talk to this issue.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ilya Kuzmin. I represent KBA Fisheries Association. Long-time cod participant in the Gulf of Alaska, specifically in Central Gulf, but based out of Homer. We have to end this race for fish due to safety as number one priority. We oppose Joint Resolution 21 as it is not productive for the legislature to insert themselves into the complex fishery management issues. In HJR 21, there are misrepresentations and incorrect assertions, such as consolidation of vessels, reduction of participants, elimination of crew jobs. So we ask the committee to let the council do its job to complete this process of LLP recency. With the current final action that the council is considering, there will still be anywhere from 110 to 306 permits that will qualify. And it's totally false because of the LLP recency action that the council will take actually save crew jobs, protect long-time local Alaska fishermen that have been dependent on peacod fishery, and protect small boat owner operators from being pushed out of the fishery by bigger 58-footers that have just recently started fishing and are taking a bigger chunk of the tack. So we do not support AGR 21. I'd like to ask the committee to let the council do its process as it's intended to do. And that will be it.
Thank you, Mr. Kuzman. And we do have some written testimony that has been sent to the committee, and it is in your packets. And Mr. Kuzman, if you have additional information, please feel free to send it in, and we'll put it in the committee packets if you have written testimony. With that.
And as you know, that we have about approximately 44 members of this association that are against this House Joint Resolution 21.
Thank you, Mr. Kuzman. Now we will go to Kodiak, and we'll start with Alexis Kwajwaka.
record, my name's Alexis Kwatchka. I will be representing myself today. I'm in support of HAR 21. What I've been seeing on the federal side of these fisheries is that they all end basically in IFQ, and the IFQs are having pretty serious repercussions for coastal communities. LLP reduction, it's going to lead to sector splits, which will ultimately lead to IFQs. And it's all rationalization, and I agree with the fact that this is a very contentious and very emotional subject. But we have to have a plan for what we want our communities to look like, how we're going to have people access the fisheries. It does us no good to be in a fishing community where we look out and we can't get to the fish. And it's getting that way, and the world's getting small. I would like to kind of, I think from your perspective, you need to be looking at what's going to happen to my coastal communities. Are they going to be sustainable? Are they going to be able for new entrants to get into the fishery? Is it going to continue to be the way they are? The second thing is that what I've been hearing a lot of testimony is that the state water has 25% of the cod allocation. Well, that's just going to lead to us having to limit that fishery because it's going to put the burden of new entrants inside of 3 miles. And that needs to be a big concern for you guys, because then we're just perpetuating this limited resources here. And I don't know. I encourage you guys to be involved. I encourage there to be a plan. And I'm not in favor of the way we're headed.
Thank you, Mr. Kwatchka. Next, we'll go to Oliver Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Oliver Holm. I'm a resident of Kodiak and a third-generation Alaska fisherman. I support HJR 21. I have an inactive LLP for the Central Gulf fixed gear based on cod landings that qualified quite a few years ago. Last year, I caught over 10,000 pounds of cod, but it was in other fisheries. My LLP has been inactive because I have been tanner crab fishing during the federal cod season. There are approximately 150 inactive Kodiak tanner crab permits. These licenses will be available for those fishermen to use whenever they want to come back into the fishery based on economics. Many of these inactive crab permits people have been fishing cod in the federal season instead of crab. If the crab season were closed again, I or my son would need to fish cod instead of crab, but the FMC is headed to eliminate my cod endorsement. I am 61 years old, and my son is 21, and recently purchased a boat. I would like my LLP to be available for his use, as the jig fisheries alone would be marginal for him. Early in the year, pots are a preferred way to fish cod, and an endorsed LLP would be necessary. If the inactive LLPs are eliminated, the cost of permits, the remaining permits, will likely be pretty high and pretty much of a barrier to entry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holm. Next, we go to Sean
Doctorman. Yes, good afternoon, Chairman Johnson, Newman, House Resource members. For the record, I'm Sean Doctorman, a second-generation commercial fisherman here from Kodiak with over 30 years fishing experience under my knife belt. I'm here representing myself and my interest in the Gulf of Alaska fisheries today, even though I'm frequently a public advocate for many Alaska fishermen, their families, and coastal communities. I'm here in support of HJR 21 for many reasons. First, I'd like to review a brief history of fisheries rationalization regimes, and it seemed that Republican Osterman did a great job, and I'd just like to add a few details. 50 years ago, we became a state, and through statehood, we forced fisheries processors to start sharing profits of the resources that were extracted from this state. And it seems like we're going the other way now with the federal economic allocations of quota, and is preventing fishermen in the state of Alaska from having access to the fisheries. And I'll fast forward into the 70s, where we had limited entry in the state waters for salmon and herring. And actually, this type of rationalization is somewhat acceptable, because there was one catch. You had to harvest the fish, you actually had to put your boots on, go down to your boat, work on it, and go fishing and catch them and deliver them. And it was an owner on board fishery. And then I'll move on to the halibut fishery, which is a federal fishery managed by the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. And these IFQs, they enabled vessel owners that were initially allocated to have this superior right where they didn't even have to step on board. They could just fish from land and get paid. So, and this is what we would call an absentee owner model. And I'll try to speed up here. Next, we went on to pollock rationalization, which is another federal Bering Sea pollock rationalization, which gave exclusive rights to processors and vessels, and a lot of them were foreign-owned. And we keep getting farther and farther away from giving access to Alaskan fishermen and new entrants in the future fishermen. So lastly, I want to move on to Bering Sea crab. And this was the gifting over $1 billion worth of quota rights to about 100 individuals and corporations. And the processing rights were given to seven major processing companies and Japanese trading companies that own 40 to 50% of the processing rights. And all of these IFQs were given to quota holders forever. Consequently, there's no program to get fishing privileges back in the hands of active fishermen. And the next generation, myself included, is now sitting at this table, and we've had enough of fisheries access removal by the factions of fisheries lobbyists you will hear from today. If you're not born into a fishing family now, it will take millions of dollars invested to just catch some fish. We fought this rationalization of the Gulf of Alaska back in 2005, 2006 with Senate Bill 113, and we beat the thuggery of Ben Stevens and his cohorts. But now the North Pacific Council is trying to get Gulf of Alaska ground fish rationalization through by other means to suit the trawlers' needs of getting quota ownership and securing the high value of bycatch. Let me sum this up real quick. Removing the latent LLPs from the ground fish permit holders will leave state waters as the dumping ground for new entrants. And why shouldn't federal waters have to do this? Removing LLPs from fixed gear fishermen will simply take rights from active and future fishermen and give exclusive rights to investor-only factions who do not fish. I urge the House Resources Committee to move HJR 21A to the floor and ask all the members here to speak with their state senators representing their districts to move this resolution forward to the North Pacific Management Council.
Thank you, Mr. Dockerman.
Thank you.
Linda Kozak, and might I remember, remind folks to try and keep this to 3 minutes so we have the opportunity for everybody to speak. Linda, are you there?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name for the record is Linda Kozak, and I'm a lifelong Alaskan, grew up salmon fishing in Bristol Bay. My family still has set net operation over there at Ecock in the Nooshiegak District. And I wanted to indicate first off that I am opposed to HJR 21. I do work with longline and pot fishermen who fish cod in the Gulf of Alaska, the Bering Sea, Aleutian Islands. And I wanted to just bring us back a little moment to the fact that this is a limited entry proposal. This is not rationalization, it's limited entry. The Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission actively looks at limited entry programs for state waters fisheries. We had one here in Kodiak recently with a crab fishery for tanners. And I would like to remind the committee that while this is a proposal that's being generated at the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, the state of Alaska has 6 of the voting members. They represent a majority, and any proposal that goes through the North Pacific Council is usually spearheaded by the state of Alaska, by the administration, and the Commissioner of Fish and Game is actively working on those. And so they are thinking of what's best beneficial for Alaskans. And many of us have asked them to take some action to protect participants who have demonstrated a dependence. I have a proposal to the state and to the council that if anyone has made at least one landing of cod in the directed cod fishery since 2000 or purchased a permit for the intent purpose of fishing cod, that they will have demonstrated dependence on the fishery and should be given an endorsement for cod. I believe this is very lenient, and it will provide for the best protection for those people, particularly Alaskans who are involved in the fishery now or want to be involved in the fishery by having purchased a permit. And I am very concerned about these latent licenses sitting out here for groundfish knowing that the sheer cost of getting a vessel and purchasing a license and getting into the fishery in the coming years will likely be something that only those who have large sums of money out of Seattle, Washington, Oregon, or possibly processing interests would be able to actively do. And I think that would devastate our coastal communities. So I would ask that you not move this resolution forward and that we let the North Pacific Council do their job. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kozak. I have a question. You said that you do not support House Joint Resolution 21, but I thought you also said that you support giving an endorsement to anybody who's landed only one fish or more since 2000 to current. That would be a whole lot more than 300 people, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, what I did say specifically was that if someone made a landing, a directed cod landing, which would be not as an incidental species to another fishery that they are participating in, but if they made a directed cod landing, and no, that number's right around 300. So, and so it is pretty lenient. One landing in 9 years is not much to ask.
You, again, Representative Newman here, you said that that would be about 600. Doesn't what the North Pacific Management Council is considering is to reduce that to 300?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. If I misspoke, I apologize. That would be about 300 licenses.
Okay. Well, yeah, I thought I heard that correctly. Thank you, Mr. Kozak. And now we will go to Julie Bonney.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Bonney, and I work for harvesters that fish out of the Central Gulf of Alaska. Many of the vessels that I represent have both trawl endorsed licenses and fixed gear endorsed licenses, and I would the majority of my members have not done directed PCOD, and will most likely, if this action moves forward in terms of fixed gear, and will lose their endorsement. However, I'm going to say right up front that I my members and myself oppose House Joint Resolution 21. And the reason is if you know, first of all, this is not rationalization in terms of quota share. It's a licensing permit, very similar to limited entry that we have in our state fisheries. But you have to understand that when you manage fisheries, that you have to look at after the resource and develop a management regime that works for the fishery. So when, way back when, and from the period 1992 to 95, the council created a licensing program, and the number of licenses that were generated in the Central Gulf was 883. To get a license, you had to deliver either two ground fish, one, so two fish or three fish to get a license. It created a huge number of licenses, and the council, North Pacific Management Council, knew that at that time, with the idea that those fishermen had an opportunity to go out, invest into the fishery, and get involved. During the last, since 2000, only 300 people, as Linda suggests, made one landing in 9 years, and the other 500 licenses had no participation at all. So this is basically, yes, removing licenses, but it's trying to take care of those participants that have invested large amounts of money to be involved in that fishery. They chose to invest in cod versus being involved in crab or salmon or other fisheries that that other folks have and they don't have access to. So you got to look at the fairness issue. But I'll make a note that once they put in the 883 licenses, then the state stepped up and took 25% of the cod quota and gave it to a state fishery. So now we're operating on a federal fishery with 75% of the pie instead of 25, which means that there's less cod to go around, yet the number of licenses are the same. National Marine Fisheries Service, at our last discussion under this, said that if all 883 licenses were active in the fishery, they would have no choice but to close it because it would be unmanageable. So we got to say, not only do you have to balance access, but you also have to balance the resource and the management of the resource. I also want to point out that there is a package in this that deals with entry opportunities, which is all vessels with five machines per jig would be exempt from any LLP requirements. So that means they would have access from 0 to 200 miles, which is the kind of the trade-off for the reduction of the pot and long line endorsements. So with that, I'll quit. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bonnie. We will now go to Representative Seaton had a question for Ms. Bonnie.
Yes, thank you. You know, one concern that has been expressed is that if the state waters will not be limited, that's 0 to 3. And currently we have a large percentage of the what's called the federal season, and really the parallel season is conducted in both state and federal waters. If you limit the LLPs so that you limit the participants in the federal waters, that the probability will be that any new entrants will come into state waters, and then of course the Board of Fish will be under pressure to control the harvest of all the fish within 3 miles or more fish within 3 miles. So wouldn't you anticipate if this happens that there will be a movement to take more than 25%, in fact, probably move towards the true allocation of fish that are caught within the 0 to 3 miles and regulate them under a state water fishery instead of having it be that the federal waters had 75%?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Seaton, or Representative Seaton, actually, right now, under the federal season, people fish from 0 to 3 miles with a federal LLP. So it's not just non-license holders that fish in the federal fishery from 0 to 3. And if you look, so there's always been that open entry where you could fish inside 3 miles in the parallel fishery. And the reality is only 2% of the actual cod catch in the federal quota has been taken by non-LLP holders. So I guess the scenario is the potential's there, but under the present system, it hasn't become a reality. The other issue when you talk about, you know, if you reallocate and force more harvest inside 3 by increasing the state quota from 25 to some other number, you have to deal with the Stellar Sea Lion ESA requirements, and there's a potential that you could have some issues with that, since the most critical habitat for Stellar Sea Lions is within 3 miles. So there's some trade-offs there. It's another one of those complex issues that isn't simple, that would take a lot, probably years to sort out. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bynum. We now go to Frank Miles. And Representative Osterman, I'd like to ask you, too, his testimony, if you have comments on what you've heard. I'd like to get some feedback when we get done with that, if we can. Frank Miles.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. My name is Frank Miles, 39-year resident of Kodiak. I've been fishing codfish since 1988, all out of Kodiak here. Primarily, my history involves hired skipper activities through 1998. After that point, I personally was... I had gotten in and bought a boat, a smaller boat, a 35-footer. There came a time where I was trying to upgrade my vessel, which we had some issues with fishing the winter fishery on a 35-footer, and we were using longline gear. I had, initially I'd seen the boat owner, based upon my history, get the LLPs in his name. He was no longer actively fishing. I was working the boat, but based upon my catch history, he got the right or the access to the fish stocks. There came a point to where I wanted to get my own program going. I went out and I bought an LLP, and it's important to note that these LLPs are transferring and have been transferring on the open market for a dollar value. So, you know, personally, I've gone out and invested in the fishery, buying a permit, buying the gear, buying the boat. So we attempted to upgrade our boat for safety reasons, and I bought a 45-footer. But the, you know, this federal program is pretty rigid in that it favors other sectors, and large boats in particular, and it kind of leaves small boat fishermen behind in that the length overall, you're allowed 15% increase on your vessel size. And I went from a 35-footer to a 45-footer, and unfortunately, my LLP, with all my history, could not be used on that 45-footer. So I went back out in the market and purchased another LLP just so I could fish the 09 season. But as written, this federal program would completely leave us out. We're long-time participants. And it's also important to note, in the state water fishery, pots and jig gear are the only gear groups that get to participate. If you're a longliner, you've got the federal season. You do not get the option of state waters. So I find that the program is leaving out a whole, the LLP program is leaving out a whole group of guys that made modest upgrades, but yet they're being penalized, and their LLPs could be taken away from them, irregardless of long-term investment or participation. You know, it does, the length overall issue does nothing to stop the bigger boats from sponsoring. I mean, I made a modest upgrade, which increased my catch ability to 5,000 pounds overall, but yet these bigger boats can sponsor 12 feet, 15 feet wide, and go from 150,000 pound capacity to 300 plus.
Could you wrap it up, please, Mr. Miles?
Excuse me?
Could you wrap up, please?
Yeah, okay, yeah, in closing, I just want to say again that I support HJR 21, and I think it sends a good message to the council that, you know, the highest positions of government are not in favor of continuing to close the door on small boat fishermen. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miles. Next, go to DJ Vinberg. DJ Vinberg in Kodiak.
I'm here. Thank you. My name is DJ Vinberg, and I have fished in Kodiak for 40 years. I'm a third-generation fisherman and own and operate the same boat, now called the Family Pride, as my father before me. I've heard a lot of testimonies here, and a lot of points are agreed. Personally, maybe from a selfish point of view, I am opposed to HJR 21. Morally, I agree with the open fishing concept. But I live and fish in a real world and have felt the impact of rationalization for 14 years. The race for history is on. Pandora's box is open. And those of us with a long history, in Kodiak in particular, are not protected. With relatively no restrictions, our cod fishing is rapidly becoming a derby-style fishery, not unlike halibut fishing in the past. A cod season used to be 3 or 4 months. This year it was 26 days. And 30 more boats more than 2 years ago participated. Boats came from the West Coast due to a depressed dungey economy. What happens if that whole economy fails and this is open? Those boats are going to come up here. A large portion were longliners from the peninsula, and most disturbing to me were larger boats from out west who have crab IFQs, who are now free to participate in any open fishery at no risk to their already banked crab money. The cod fishery represents 50% of my yearly income. In 2009, the length of time for fishing the federal cod was reduced to 26 days, and state cod for 14. This has put me in survival mode. If left unchecked, our cod fishery will be overcapitalized with emphasis on quantity and not quality in a season that may last less than 30 days. This allows for a more depressed price, more risky fishing, as a day due miss to weather is a missed opportunity with the clock ticking. I personally feel that there should be more restrictions on access to our cod fishery and definitely more qualifying years set in place. The 800 LLP plus permits in the Central Gulf is a joke. and does nothing to protect me or boats like me who live in Kodiak are totally committed to the fishery and spend 100% of my income in Kodiak. My options are limited to Kodiak. I'm too small to chase cod out west, and my business is in jeopardy if my piece of the cod pie, quote-unquote, continues to shrink. Hard choices have to be made. You can't privatize big chunks of our Alaska fisheries, thus protecting those participants, and leave the rest of us who are not so lucky totally exposed. While not in favor of further privatization, IFQs, I think a limited number of permits is a good tool to start with and throw out any LLPs with no recency. I participate in the salmon. The other half of my income is from salmon, and that's a good example of a well-structured fisheries. You have a limited permit. Okay, I'll wrap it up here. While I appreciate the opportunity to express my concerns about the future of my livelihood, I am also concerned about the Alaska legislature's ability to undermine the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. I think you should be concerned about our fisheries and knowledge about our situation, but at the same time, be respectful of those whose sole responsibility is to make fishery management decisions. If you don't trust them, why should I?
Thank you, Mr. Vinberg. Yeah, there was a comment made by my coach here. I think it's a good point. I think he's right. Ryan Johnson.
Yeah, good afternoon, Chairman. My name's Ryan Johnson. I'm a Kodiak resident here and kind of represent some, well, I represented myself, but I'm here speaking for some people that are falling through the cracks on this this LLP reduction. I've been fishing codfish since 1997 on my small boat, which is a 38-footer. And in about 2002, I went out and I bought an LLP for my boat and participated in the cod fishery and earned history. And that LLP is going to qualify under this plan. But after quite a few years of winter fishing on a very small boat, I decided to buy a little bit bigger boat, and I made a modest upgrade to a 48-foot boat, which was expensive, and I have extensive mortgage payments to make, and cod fishing is very important to me. I also bought an LLP that works with my larger boat. My previous LLP that went with my smaller boat is too small by 2 feet. So this new LLP that I have is doesn't have any deliveries, but I actually paid green money for it. It's an important part of my business plan, and I need it to survive. Just in the last year alone, I've spent upwards of $30,000 on pots and cod fishing gear. And if I were to be excluded from cod fishing or be forced to buy a new permit under this reduction, it just causes me to incur more debt and makes things difficult. Now, I realize that 800 and whatever permits is a lot of permits, and you know, to have them all fishing would be bad. But there's no way that'll ever happen. The economics of the fishery wouldn't, and people just couldn't go fishing. There were guys who went fishing this winter and lost money. They're just here fishing for history. So when the council talks about these rationalization and reduction programs, people get all wound up and they go fishing for no reason. And a lot of it are wealthy boat owners sitting on the couch sending their boats fishing, making their crews work for almost nothing just so they can gain history. So it's really frustrating for me to watch watch these guys who don't even go fishing anymore, and they spend their dollars on lobbyists who go to the council and spend countless hours to figure up these schemes, and they leave all of the working fishermen who live here and are trying to put down roots in Kodiak and Alaska behind. And really, this just needs to stop. If the council would just leave it alone, the economics of the fishery would regulate it. The seasons would get longer. And if people couldn't afford to go, then they wouldn't go, and that's just the way it should be. So I wholeheartedly support HJR 21, and thank Representative Osterman and Representative Edgeman for drafting this. And I think that the state of Alaska has every right to flex its muscle at the council, and the legislature has every right to weigh in. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, I just want to go back to a comment you made that. You're concerned that you said that, using your words, that wealthy boat owners send their boats out there, although they know they're not going to probably catch a lot of fish, which puts the crewmen
out there working with probably not a lot of income. Is that what I heard, or how does that
work? That's exactly the case. You know, a lot of these guys who are going to benefit from this are going to they're larger boat owners, and so their LLPs are going to be worth more money. So say you own like an 85-foot pot boat. I'm going to guess that LLP with its COD endorsement under this program is going to be worth somewhere in the $300,000 to $500,000 range, and I think that might even be a conservative estimate. And these guys are also the very same people who received halibut IFQs for free and blackcod IFQs for free. And I can think particularly of one person who testified at our last hearing, who owns two boats that are capped out on both halibut and blackcod. He probably has $8 million worth of quota. That's the market value of it. And so this guy doesn't even go fishing. He doesn't put his boots on. He sits there and watches the money roll in and pays lobbyists. So it's quite frustrating for a real fisherman, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Stephen Toffin.
Good afternoon, Chairman Johnson, Chairman Newman. I'm Stephen Toffin of the Groundswell Fisheries Movement. And I'm here in support of the resolution. There should be a document show up on site that expressed some things I told the subcommittee earlier on fisheries. This is an economic issue. It is a fight that's on the pathway to more rationalization. And it is important to slow down this process on removing access, especially as the sponsor said, absent a biological concern. I appreciate the honest testimony of people like DJ Vinberger earlier. However, you also heard from a faction that's trying to make safety an issue, yet while it may come into play, crab rationalization had safety be the big issue as well without any insurance companies, loan line experts, marine architects, or others testifying, because it was also solely about economics, but they're not allowed under federal law to make it so they have to add in these other concerns as a distractor. You know, this week, upcoming Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke strongly stated that he would concentrate on preserving American jobs. I think we need to note that. Job creation is all about opportunities of preserving access under free enterprise rights. Further consolidation and concentration will not serve the preservation of these jobs. And so I greatly welcome the role of the state legislature speaking in. In fact, as a side note, I've long believed we need a deputy attorney general in attendance at all the council meetings to represent especially small shareholder interests as well as inform the state bodies appropriately of what's going on. You know, there's an unspoken truth here about what is rational when prices are low, maybe not to go out and fish for history, but to simply leave the fish in the water to propagate and grow. And you know, I think it's important to send a message that there's going to be no more giving away of history under this specially chosen set of qualifying years. Don't be fooled. This is the pathway to rationalization. If not, why would the council's majors talk about catch history and stacked licensing provisions? If they want LLP removal, then these groups that want it, then they intend to do sector splits, which is indeed on the path to rationalization. And this council, it has an alternative in its package for no action. So I think that sends a message that no action, the current fisheries management plan, is a viable position to maintain. And I'd like you to keep in mind that it's the council's job to take public input. So it is very important for the state to weigh in also. This does not undermine the council's actions. And again, I favor this joint resolution and alternative one for no action, and I welcome your further involvement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Toffin. Also, the legislature's job is to take public input. Anybody left in Kodiak that would like to testify?
No one else.
Okay. Hearing none, we will move to Anchorage. Tony Ruggiero.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee,
Tony, morning, Tony, could you please state your name and affiliation?
My name is Tony Gregorio. I represent the Chignik Lagoon Village Corporation. I fished in Chignik since 1959 and went through the years of crab and then the IFQ stuff and the downfall of crab, and then we went into cod because you can't make it just by salmon fishing alone anymore. So, I favor this House joint resolution because we've been trying to work with the North Pacific Council to slow down these deals because it's hurting the small communities. A lot of the people down in my area would like to go out there and do the fishing in Chignik, but Chignik is the worst possible place to be cod fishing in the wintertime. Sustaining winds, I mean, the winds are 50 to 60 miles an hour constantly. Excuse me. And all I want to say is, like I've been saying to the North Pacific Management Council, the coastal communities have to be addressed. And when you take away latent LLPs and stuff like that, it's just you're just closing the door little by little. And this, like the last speaker said and two before him, this is just we're on the road to rationalization. And it needs to be slowed down or stopped or something. And that's the reason I'm speaking in favor of this resolution. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Freddie Christensen.
Hello.
Oh, Freddie.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Freddie Christensen. I was born and raised in Kodiak Island, a village called Old Harbor. I've participated in most of fisheries, been fishing since I was 6, 7 years old. I have had the opportunity to experience the first negative impacts of the limited entry permit system that took away opportunities for people in our communities. So I'm one of the guys that's really opposed to any kind of rationalized fishery, limited entry, whether it be the federal side or state side, for purposes of it's taking access and opportunities away from our people in our coastal communities that have depended on the resources since millennium. If you can go to archaeological sites and find proof that there are cod bones in these archaeological sites, therefore, the fish have been around for hundreds and thousands of years, and I don't see where there's a need to limit and give a resource away to an elite group of people when these resources are adjacent to our communities in the Gulf of Alaska. So I support HDR 21 for purposes of slowing it down and trying to come up with better measures of community protections. And I'm not only speaking to the smaller communities, but to the larger communities as well. And I have, you know, I will admit that I have friends and that are on both sides of this argument. But I think the main thing is to remember that this is the last possible rationalized fisheries. And I just believe that there needs to be a way, and I know that there's a way if we all work together and trying to come up with a way of protecting the small boat guys, you know, because that's the guys that I pretty much represent in the Gulf of Alaska. But we do support HDR 21, and again, it's the beginning of a rationalized fishery, and I think access. You know, there's some ideas out there doing a super exclusive to keep the fishermen, you know, within the Kodiak Island. You make a decision to fish the Bering Sea or out west or Chignik or what have you, or Kodiak. And I think there's ways of limiting the amount of boats that are coming in and, participating for purposes of just documenting history. But I appreciate Representative Osterman and everybody else's involvement because I think it's time that the state stood up and took a lead in protecting their communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Anybody else in Anchorage or off net elsewhere? Hearing none, we will close testimony for online testimony. Do we have anybody in the room who would like to testify on House Joint Resolution 21? Hearing and seeing none, we will close public testimony at this time. Come back to the room. Representative Osterman, did you hear anything that you'd like to comment on? Jump at you?
No, Mr. Chairman, other than I think that the both sides of the testimony indicate that there are, no matter what you do, there's always going to be two sides to a story. And in this case, I believe that it's purely economics that's driving the drive to put these endorsements on. And the sad part about that is the economics that they drive out of the endorsement really leave other people out. And those people, the Alaskans that I think that need to be protected in this issue and given the opportunity for reasonable access into stepping up into the fishery on the federal side and not just completely or basically being blocked out by excessive access.
Thank you. Representative Osterman, we've heard a lot about the terms rationalization and limited entry. Could you briefly describe your opinion of how you would, could you describe those?
I've got a lot of respect for people who have looked at rationalization in a number of different ways, and I have a lot of respect for those people who don't agree with me. And as I indicated when I first testified, some people look at rationalization as only those only for those programs where the resource was actually given away and it was rationalized into ownership. In my view, and has been for a long time, is that every fishery in Alaska is going to be rationalized in one form or another over time. As we get more and more fishing, more and more entrants into the fishery, and it was brought up several times today about maybe there's going to be end up being too many boats in the fishery, and there's going to be this race for fish, and DJ Vinberg pointed out that he's down to 26 days on the federal fishery and 14 on the state water fishery on the cod. And so at some point in time, and it's no different than what happened with the IFQs, the halibut, there was a race for fish. There were people dying, and they were doing 48 to 24-hour openers, and that did create a problem. And I don't have a bit of problem with the fact that they came by and said, okay, we're going to do an IFQ program so that we can stop these deaths, we can improve the quality of the fish, and we can get a better market for it if we extend it over time by giving these IFQs out to fishermen so they can fish whenever they wanted to. What I disagree with is the fact that there's a better way of doing that when it got down to what you did with the IFQ. If they had not given the ownership of the IFQ to the fishermen and had rolled it over in some method, I'm not suggesting how, but if they had rolled it over every 5 to 7 years or whatever that magical number is for amortizing your investment, and brought it back for somebody else to get into the fishery, then I think it would have been a better program. And so I look at rationalization as salmon rationalization. I look at it as cod rationalization. I look at it as halibut, crab. They're all rationalized programs to me. So it's really in who you're talking to and how they're interpreting it.
Thank you, Representative Osterman. Representative Gutenberg, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Seaton. Gutenberg and then Seaton.
Thank you. How effective have resolutions like this been in influencing the
can't hear you.
I'm sorry. How effective have resolutions like this been in affecting the management council's decision-making process?
Representative Gutenberg, could you lower your microphone? Thank you.
You want me to repeat it again? Yeah. Thank you. How effective have resolutions like this been in the past affecting the decision-making process?
I don't know.
Okay.
Because I think this is the first one that comes out of the state of Alaska, particularly the legislature, asking for them to change the way they're doing business. One of the things that I did learn, as most of you know, I was a legislator for eight years plus before I went to work for the Governor Frank Murkowski as his fishery policy advisor. And my job with him during those 4 years was to attend every one of these meetings and report back to him on what was going on. And in my view, it became very apparent that the policy decisions in the federal government on the North Pacific Council, even though there's six Alaskans that actually could dominate out of 11 voting members, there's a lot of times that the decisions that were being made at that council were not necessarily favorable to Alaska. And so I came away from those 4 years of working for the governor realizing that if I got back in the legislature, that the legislature needs to stand up and say, it's time that we also had a voice in the policy decisions that affect Alaskans and its communities.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, I think it's important for everybody to understand that we do have, that this is a license limitation program, on the federal side, just like we have the salmon license limitation on the state side and herring and others. But what's being attempted to do now is go along and say, we're going to cut out more than half of the licenses. So we have a lot of licenses that aren't being fished right now in Cook Inlet because the economics aren't there. And that's a good decision when we don't have fishermen going out and participating just because they have to have history. It's a good decision to have those things based on economics and the participation based on economics. And we should realize that the groundfish license covers all species. But if you take out cod and you say, okay, you have a groundfish license, but it can never fish cod, all of a sudden it basically zeroes out that license because you have to do things in combination. And if you take out the most profitable fishery of the unit, the rest of them go away. So I have friends on both sides of this issue. I am worried that we'll have communities that want to have a small processor come in to be able to do something in the future, and there won't be enough licenses available for the people in the community to be able to access those fisheries. So that's one of the reasons why, I'm supporting this.
Did you have a question for Representative Osterman, or did we get into committee discussion already?
I thought we were on committee discussion. I'm sorry.
We're getting there. Representative Wilson, do you have a question for Representative Osterman?
Yes, I do.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Osterman, is it because I'm just trying to think of what the ramifications are and why they're why what's happening is now, and is it because that maybe the bigger boat owners have more money and they can afford to go to Washington and lobby and things like that, or else hire a lobbyist to go, it's that kind of end of it that's getting more help than the end with the little guys? Or is it just totally some other reason?
Well, Representative Wilson, through the chair, I think that the real problem deals with how the council is made up. And the council is made up of pretty much of industry people. They have an advisory panel that's got about 20 people on it, I think. And very few, maybe one or two of those, are not industry people that are involved. So inherently, what you have is the industry speaking at every level of what they want to see. But the people that can afford to go to 8 or 9 of these meetings a year and spend, a full week and a half at them are those people who have money. And so the people who have money that may be fishing even, hire lobbyists to go and speak for them at these meetings. People that are not speaking up are the silent majority of Alaskans who are going to be affected in the long term on this issue. Half the people who spoke today are small boat people or they're involved in trying to protect Alaskans rather than the big boat people. And half of the people who spoke today are tied to the industry and are paid to come and make those, make that point that we have to protect those people who are currently in the industry, which I disagree with, and I think that particularly in this issue where we're talking about from western Gulf of Alaska, from Sandpoint all the way to Yakutat, that's a big area. And those are the people we're talking about. Every community in the Gulf can and will be affected. And so with that, I just think it's a system that they have, and they're not elected officials that sort of make that determination. Or people get appointed by the governors or by the secretaries of state or within a state. There's 5 people that are from Washington, Oregon on there, and they're appointed either by the governor or by the Division of Fisheries or somebody like that. So it's not an elected body that's it here. And the system is made up to have, and that's the way the system is made up across every organization of this type across the nation. And I think there's 8 councils from the East Coast up to Alaska.
Thank
Representative
you.
Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Officers, thank you for bringing this forward. I guess my question is, I want to be real clear. This fishery is not in any kind of distress. It's not overfished. We're not talking a situation where this is a management tool to make for a stronger, better fishery? And just on the record, would you kind of clarify that, make sure that we're talking about an economic decision and not a biological decision, so that we're just very clear that we're doing this for the right reasons?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Johnson. That is correct, and I think we've provided you guys with a 70 or 80 some page deal from the North Pacific Council. And if you start right at the problem statement when they define why they're doing this and read through it, just about every sentence, and it talks about protecting those who are currently fishing, economically protecting them so they're not hurt by other people coming in and taking away a percentage that they're catching. And that's how the whole system, and you can go all the way back to when they originally started writing these problem statements on this particular issue, and they all talk about economics. The fishery right now is not biologically threatened at all. There are economic issues that threaten people, and that's where the North Pacific Council, and in the parallel fisheries inside of Alaska, that and state water fisheries, where the management scheme by the North Pacific Council and NOAA and the management system by Alaska, the Board of Fish, need to watch and make sure. I mean, there's ways of controlling the damage that you can do on stocks. You limit the amount of pots these guys can fish, you limit the amount of hooks they can fish, you limit the size of their boats, you limit the width of their boats, you limit their tonnage. You do those kind of things as a management scheme that actually protects the resource. Going to just saying that it's going to be a better sustainable fishery because we're going to limit it to 300-some cod fishermen doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to do that. Each one of those 300 could lengthen their boat, get more pots. They could all go out and do the exact same thing. So that's not the issue.
Thank you, Representative Austin. Any more questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I just want to be real. Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to be clear that we're doing this for the right reasons, that there's not a this is not a distressed fishery. This is clearly a political decision, not a biological decision on the part of the North Pacific Fisheries. And I just want to, you know, be real clear on the record that we're talking about a political decision, not a biological decision. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I wouldn't phrase it as a political decision. I would phrase it as the economics that we're talking about, and the economics are driving what we're doing, and the economic pressure that is brought on those 11 members of the North Pacific Council is economic pressure, and not biological pressure.
Thank you, Representative Osterman. Any more questions for Representative Osterman? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Osterman.
Thank you.
We'll bring it back to the committee for committee discussion. Do you have anything more to add, Representative Seaton?
No, I think I got out of sequence there, I thought. So I think, I guess I would like to add, you know, I have people on both sides of this issue, but I think the thing that we haven't talked about is what are the consequences of doing this, consequences for coastal communities and the future consequence of the allocation between state water fisheries and federal fisheries. Because if we reduce the access for coastal Alaskans to the federal fishery, then what we're going to do is we're going to have pressure to have the Board of Fish take control of more of the fish within state waters for state water access. We have 25%, which was a number that's not all the fish that are within state waters, because the parallel fishery, that which is 75% of it, a good portion of that is done within state waters. And so I can sure see the pressure coming if we do reduce the access for Alaskans to be able to participate in the federal waters. I can sure see a movement to take a greater percentage into the state water the state water guideline harvest, which has restrictive amount of spots and jigs, which would cut out some of our coastal vessels that use long lines. So I can see the ramifications going much farther than just what boats are going to be in and what boats are going to be out. So I just like to let the committee know that, and I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So if I can ask you a question, Representative Seaton, on that. So what I just heard is you're concerned about more federal impacts
the federal government imposing its opinions or its rules on how Alaska's manage our fisheries or how it affects individual Alaskans?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, what I'm saying is if we cut down the availability of federal licenses to coastal fishermen, what we're going to do is then have the pressure to have the Board of Fisheries take control of more of the fish, of the codfish that are in state waters. And the impact of that is going to be to shift from current gear types that are used to the gear types that are allowed in the state water fishery. And I think that that would be the ultimate outcome of this. And I don't think that I don't think that's good for the mix of Alaska fishermen as well, but I think that that's what would happen. And so I'm
more impact on that 0-3.
That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Yeah, more comment than anything else. Yeah, I'd like to thank the sponsor of the bill and the three co-sponsors that are sitting around the table. I've been involved in the Cook Inlet Salmon Wars for about 25 years, either actively or as a participant or as a spectator. And I know that after you vote today, assuming we vote on this, that you're going to make half the people in your communities happy, and the other half are going to be upset, no matter how you vote. So my hat's off to you.
That's about as making policy calls based on what you think is right and not politics, Representative Olson.
That's what I mean.
Absolutely. Thank you. Any other more committee comment?
Ready for a motion, Mr. Chair?
Seeing none, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move HJR number 21 with individual recommendation and attached zero fiscal note out of committee.
Seeing no objection, this bill moves out of committee. And we will take an ad ease while we send the vote. Next up is House Bill 70, which has to do with a little bit of agricultural issues. Representative Gatto, the Alaska Bureau of Agricultural Products. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's great to be back. I miss this place, and I feel comfortable in this room. I've asked my committee aide, Sandra Wilson, if she would like to make the sponsor statement on the bill, and if that's acceptable, then I'll ask her to do it.
Okay. All right, for the record, my name is Sandra Wilson, staff to Representative Gatto. This bill intends to connect farmers with school procurement officers in order to get fresh-grown fruits and vegetables into Alaska schools. There's currently an Alaska law that says that schools who get both fishery products as well as agricultural products are required to get them from in-state as long as it's no higher in price than 7% of what they can get from somewhere grown in the lower 48. The bill would set up for DNR, along with a couple others, including the Department of Education and Early Development, to determine how they wanted to develop the program and how they wanted to implement the program, but it would be under DNR supervision to implement the program. And finally, the bill also sets out it would allow school districts to do school gardens or farms, and in doing so, local school organizations are the ones who would be running the gardens and the farms, and they would learn both organic as well as conventional farming methods.
Thank you, Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's some other parts of this bill that are not clearly here, but they apply just as well. And that is, I've read some reports that Alaska maintains about a four-day supply of food. That seems low, but gee, what if it's even more than 4 days? And the idea for this bill came about on the trip to Dillingham, where I talked to, just accidentally talking to people from the school district who told me that they had a lot of frozen fish, frozen salmon, quite a bit more than they could use. And so the idea, I said, can we trade? We have a lot. At the time, the Matt May Dairy was still in operation. I said, can we trade milk, potatoes, carrots, rhubarb, pick it? And so the idea of exchanging food among the schools was an idea that didn't really become successful. Mostly, I think it was transportation costs. But we still have this idea of taking locally grown food and moving it from the farm to the school. And admittedly, there's a 7% incentive to do that. That means they're going to be able to charge 7% higher and still make that bid equal to the next lower bid. So that's part of the bill. There are some other parts, as Sandra mentioned, about gardening and about some other issues. But basically, it's the idea, as much as we can, to make Alaska, to think of Alaska as pretty minor, but it is a farm state of about $50 million a year. And in many states, that wouldn't even be one farm. But then we don't have a population of many states. So if indeed we can do anything to encourage the idea of producing our own food in this state, I think that's a great idea, and this bill moves us in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gatto. Last year, when we were in Dillingham together, they introduced us to a program where their local schools there were eating some fresh sockeye salmon donated by their very generous commercial fishermen into the schools. And I know both you and I looked at if we could trade milk for fish, you know, to try and move that around the state to try and help everybody, because we were at the time dumping milk on the ground, you know, instead of getting it to school kids. A sin in my mind. You know, to talk about how these programs can maybe help bring different areas of the state together.
Well, any time we do have communication between the schools, even if it's the school nutritionist, but the idea of having a lunch at Palmer High that says fish donated by Dillingham School District or traded by Dillingham School District. You know, we have sports. We have some other ways to communicate between and among the schools, but this adds one way, and it certainly gets us excited about living in Dillingham and actually realizing that the food on your tray came within the state of Alaska. And I usually think of carrots and potatoes as the good root crops that we actually can store pretty well over long periods of time. But there's also some fresh crops too. The milk was always harder, much harder. Doable, but you know, it's a competition for milk. Usually a store will give it as a loss leader. Very hard to compete for the milk market, but it turned out that, of course, the dairy could make pretty good cheese that could be transported easily. So as we develop along the lines of putting food, local food, into local schools, I think the whole idea may actually have an ability to expand.
And I just want to make sure we've got a couple of students, 4-H kids, in the audience today that would like to testify, and we have some people that have taken the time to go to the LIOs. We've got about 15 minutes left, so I want to try and get those people in first here, and then we can come back to Representative Gatto for some more questions. I'd like to maybe ask him or start thinking about how, if there's tax breaks involved in this, if they donate food to this, how that could be going. But again, I want to make sure that we allow our public to testify, some of the most important people that we hear from. So at that time, if you would, if we could move aside Representative Gatto and have Jessica Lavlar. LaVar.
Hello. Good morning, everyone. Chairman Johnson and Chairman Newman and members of the House Resources Committee. My name is Jessica Lavlar. I'm here to speak in favor of this bill, House Bill 70, and I'm here representing myself. First of all, I think that supporting local agriculture in Alaska is very important from an economic standpoint. It's vital that we support our local farmers. And we all need to eat, so we might as well put money in the pockets of our friends and neighbors while we move forward in meeting that basic need. From an ecological standpoint, I think it's entirely unsustainable to continue to get the majority of our foods from outside of Alaska. And also from a health standpoint, fresh produce is, of course, superior nutritionally to that which, you know, sits on boats, planes, and shelves for days or even weeks. And I grew up in Anchorage, eating foods almost exclusively flown in from out of state. Lunches I ate in school cafeterias were lacking. They're usually pretty unpalatable, and to my knowledge, were entirely grown, harvested, and cooked outside of Alaska. So partially for that reason, I think public schools are a great place to start supporting local agriculture. House Bill 70 will be a great first step in helping students both connect to their food supply while helping them eat healthier, and at the same time providing a ready market for farmers. So really, it's a win-win situation, and I strongly support this bill. I hope you will all consider passing it through the committee, and I thank you so much for taking your time for me today and for all of your hard work.
Thank you, Ms. LeVar. Gail Eastwood, are you available?
Can you hear me?
Yes, Gail. Name and affiliation, please.
Yeah. My husband and I are both totally in favor of House Bill 70. We have a farm up in Delta Junction, and we also live in Petersburg where we commercial fish during the odd seasons. Anyway, we totally feel that it also is beneficial to have the farm provide food for our students in the school districts because of the nutritional value of the locally grown product versus the product that is brought in that is not ripe when it is harvested and then gets gassed or whatever process they have to try and ripen it so it looks palatable on the shelves. And we feel that anything that can be done to enhance the nutrition value of food for our kids, as well as assisting the farmers in Alaska, we think is a wonderful first step, and we are totally, absolutely, 100% in favor of that.
Thank you, Ms. Eastwood. Anybody else off net? Hearing none, we'll move into the audience here, where we've got some 4-H kids. Zoe Fuller.
Good afternoon.
Alaska Youth for the Environment.
Yes, Alaska Youth for Environmental Action. Good afternoon, members of the House Resources, and Chairman Newman and Chairman Johnson. My name is Zoe Fuller, and I'm here to speak about House Bill 70, Alaska-grown agricultural products, and give recommendations. Like almost all youth my age, I attend a public high school, and I'm a daily witness to the unsustainability of school food systems. Food is prepackaged, frequently wasted, and is often flown in from out of state using fossil fuels. Students need better alternatives to the status quo of school food. The bill, Alaska-grown agricultural products, would provide support to schools' procurement of local food and the establishment of school gardens and farms. The bill is ecologically friendly and would be good for Alaska's economy by providing support to local farmers. We want to feel the connection to our food. Local food and school farms could drastically improve students' connection to their food and students' connection to their school. Students need you to pass House Bill 70 in support of Alaska-grown agricultural products. Thank you very much for your hard work, and thank you for allowing me the chance to speak today.
Thank you, Zoe. Any questions? Thank you, Zoe. Next, I'd like to bring up Michaela Rice.
Thank you. I'm Michaela Rice, and I'm from Fairbanks in the Tanaw District 4-H. And I like this bill, but there are some friendly amendments, you could say. Sorry. Well, what I like about what I like about this bill is that it would provide fresher and healthier foods to the schools. I think that since we live in Alaska and we're so far away, Alaska Grown's motto, you could say, is fresher by far. So I like that part of it. Also, I think that it could have an education on where food comes from. Not from the store where it's packaged in plastic, but from a farm that's in Alaska. I think it could sustain the agricultural industry in Alaska as well. Right now, farms are hard to find in Alaska, and the ones that are, they're lower scale. So I think that by giving them a customer, it would encourage farmers to keep on farming and not get rid of their animals or their crops and whatnot. The idea of gardens in school is also something I liked. I think that it could teach what many kids don't know. I go to Tannenbaum Middle, and I can tell you that most of the kids at that school can't tell you how to plant a seed. So it could help. And I think that it could also grow Alaska's agricultural dependence on Alaskan agriculture and not so much dependence on Washington and other states. Some of the things that we noticed, though, looking through this, is with the gardens and greenhouses, Delta Junction, Homer, Palmer, they've all had the greenhouse at their high schools and schools that were ran with the FFA program. When the FFA program left and got smaller, so did the production of the greenhouse. Without ag education in the schools, this idea of having gardens, farms, greenhouses at the schools isn't going to be as successful as it could be if we had ag education. But where are the teachers going to come from with the natural resource and ag background? We can't have somebody who's never touched a plant in the dirt their whole life come and try to teach kids how to sustain themselves in an agricultural manner. We have to have the teachers for that. So before greenhouses and gardens can be implemented into schools, there needs to be an agricultural education implemented. Also, I had a couple questions on this. One,
Michaela?
Yes?
If you could submit the questions, maybe the committee, or just give them to Representative Gatto, maybe he'll address them, because we don't usually...
What it is it says here in the bill that the education for it would go through different departments, and one of them was the Cooperative Extension Service. So we were wondering where the partnership is currently on that matter. We came here to Juneau to tell legislators about how the Cooperative Extension Service is stretched to its limits currently as far as staff and time because of the current funding. So we were wondering where the funding is going to come to sponsor a teacher or an agent that can help the schools with this program. One thing we noticed in the bill also is the definition of Alaska grown. It said in the bill that Alaska grown means it's grown in Alaska and packed or processed in Alaska. So does that mean that we can have milk shipped up from Washington, have it processed here, and then call it Alaska grown? So those were a couple friendly amendments to the bill and comments that I had. I think it's a great idea, but there are steps we need to take before we can fully implement it into our schools. Also, the growing season is another concern. We have the summertime. When we're in school, the growing season's ending or just starting. So the growing season doesn't match as well as it could. But we like the idea, or I like the idea of this bill. I think we do need fresher food. We do need more agricultural education in this way. But there are steps that need to be taken before it can be fully implemented. So thank you.
Thanks, Michaela, and I think Representative Gatto or his staff were taking notes there, and I think you bring up some good points, and boy, that Alaska grown, that's an issue on its own. Hopefully we're going to solve that one today. Representative Gatto?
Mr. Chair, I've considered an amendment to change the growing season.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that'll be on the floor with the daylight savings time fix.
Yeah. I did fail because I didn't realize that we do have a CS. So before we have one more person I'd like to come testify, but I want to make sure that we do our housekeeping as soon as it was brought to my attention. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the committee adopt the CS for House Bill 70, designated as 26/LS0284/R-Bannister. 21209 is a working document.
See no objection. So done. Representative Gatto, and then before we go to the CS, I'd still like to make sure that we get our one last person in the audience to testify while they can. And I don't know if we'll be able to move this out today, but because I want to make sure you get through the CS because there are substantial changes, particularly in the title.
So with that, I'd like to see Jenna Armstrong. Jenna, are you here?
Hi, my name is Jenna Armstrong. I'm 14 years old, and I'm from the Tandon District. We came down here for 4-H to learn more about the government and the youth government program, and we've been learning about the different bills and things, and so we were wanting to get involved. So with this particular bill, I agree with parts of it, and in some parts I disagree. I think this bill would need to have amendments made before it should be made into a law. The good things about it, I think that are, with Alaska grown food, it'd be healthier and fresher for the kids, and so we could have better nutrients and we could be a healthier community. And then also with the food, with the Alaska grown food, with the education of where the food comes from and what you have to do to get the food from where you start it to where you eat it, would be a really good education for the youth in our state. It would also sustain the ag and industry in Alaska, because most farmers, they're just small farmers and they don't have a lot of customers, so they're getting pushed farther and farther away, and we need to help them get more customers so they can stay in business. I think the gardens, greenhouses, and farms at school, I think those are also a good idea, so the kids could have a hands-on thing of the idea. So I also think that's a really good idea because kids can learn a lot about that. And then some of the things I think should be made changes about is the funding. Like I said, we came down here for the Youth and Government 4-H program, and we came down today and yesterday. We have been talking to the different legislators about how the Cooperative Extension Service needs more money because we are run through the university, and 4-H and the other groups and the Cooperative Extension Service have been, well, we've been flatlined with money for last couple of years, and with the prices of oil and everything going up, it's been really hard to get around. Like, we only have, if you count all the agents together of part-time, quarter-time, and full-time, we only have 9 agents. So we can only do so much with those 9 agents. And we need more money to be able to do our job, because right as it was right now, there'd be more work for those 9 agents, and we wouldn't have enough money for it. We'd be basically going against this law and would probably get arrested or something for it. And then availability is another issue. Like Michaela said, we have different growing seasons from when we are in school, because we are just beginning the growing season when we leave school, and we're just ending it when we start school again. So we would have to get a summertime program or a 12-month contract with a teacher, with an ag teacher or a natural resource teacher, to help the kids come in and help water the plants and give them nutrients. So overall, I think this bill is a really good idea, but we really need some amendments to this bill before it needs to become a law.
Thank you, Jenna. And if Jenna and Michaela, if you could provide some recommendations to the committee chair of what you think, and Representative Gatto, we'll certainly open them up for discussion. Representative Edgman?
Yes, I just want to thank the previous two testifiers for the great testimony. I think they've got the bill sponsor pinned against the ropes.
Well, you know, she brings up some good points, and I have the last three chancellors at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, including Brian Rogers, just yesterday. You know, I've done quite a bit to try and thump them in the chest as much as I can to say, you know, we've got an experimental farm, and it's supposed to be based specifically just on agriculture on Trunk Road in the Mansu Valley to expand money for Cooperative Extension Service, 4-H, FFA programs. Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you. Something that accompanies bills is what's called a fiscal note. And the fiscal note is about what it would take to implement the program. And there's a $10 million fiscal note that follows this to implement those policies, to put teachers in the system to do those programs. Just to let you know, it's not, it comes with the resources. Or hopefully it comes with the resources.
Thank you, Representative Gutenberg. And again, that's on a separate attachment that we've got there. We're going to have to adjourn for the day, so Representative Gatto, when we come back, if you could be ready to explain the differences between the CS and the original bill, and for the members of the audience who've testified here, maybe have some suggestions, please get them to Representative Gatto in the chair, and we'll submit them to the members of the committee. And with that, we stand adjourned.
I think a year-round...